One is LAS, and one is this, McGurven called him, he'd been on the grand jury. I don't think he's not in that situation.
He did a damn good job.
He gets over. Mine, I mean, it's testing, it's gonna get that off. What happens? What's the situation on that contribution? Was that before, after the 10, the 7th? What is the situation? That's the only thing that you saw.
The contribution was made before, from.
Right.
Andreas Dahlberg.
Yeah, yeah.
But Dahlberg didn't go to the bank, it was a cash contribution.
Yeah.
Dahlberg didn't go to the bank until after the 7th. He went to the bank, converted it to a cashier's check, and then gave the check to Sands on the 10th.
Yeah, so.
There is a technical question. Dahlberg is a finance chairman. And the technical question is, does delivery to him constitute making the contribution?
And there was not any of it there. Delivery. Oh, I see. So what's gonna happen there? Argue about it? Yeah.
Well, I think we can work it out. Now, one thought.
Yeah.
Just now, I thought as well.
You ought to hit it two different ways. One, Travis, and as a result of the long term, and two, of course, Vietnam has virtually ended as far as we're concerned, but there are no draftees to Vietnam. And that's done. And you hit both of those points.
Very, very well. The lottery, too, is something that we've already achieved.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, apparently, the first novel, the draft is so low. If you feel sorry for the poor devils, it's been called.
Yeah.
But the most important thing is that unemployment is not being supported by war. That's a very powerful point. When you figure the fact that when we came to office in 1960, that as compared to 68, compared to now, that you have over 2 million people that are either in the armed forces or in industry related to the war that are now in labor force. This is a thing. Sure, it caused you a little problem for a while. You have enough unemployment. Where the idea of jobs not based on war is a very strong way to hit them on the negative side. In other words, they said, oh, we didn't have war. That's all right, they were in. They should be saying, What kind of a country in a world we're going to have 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now? And that's what we've been thinking about. We have done more about that. Even Harris reported in his poll this morning. We have done more about that than any administration in this century. I don't say that directly. It just happens. We were here. We took advantage of the opportunities. Maybe somebody else would have, but we did. And so, in terms not just of ending the war, which anybody probably could have done that the day we entered office. And Don Johnson and Kennedy, because they are the ones that sent and tried it. But we didn't. The reason we didn't is we have to end the war in a way that will not destroy our ability to discourage that kind of aggression that will get us involved again. So that's it. But the main point is that in terms of the kind of a world we could have just say, well, we're going to put as our first priority in this war. We could have ended the war. What kind of a world would it be? Well, it would have been a world in which the United States and the Soviet Union would have been in confrontation and in an unrestricted arms race with who knows what would have happened. It would have been a world in which the United States and Communist China would have been in total isolation and in which Communist China, which will soon have a billion people, would be the dominant power in the Pacific, not only in terms of number of people, but in terms also of its nuclear capacity. Now that isn't going to come 5 years from now or 10 years from now, but it is inevitable 50 years from now. So whoever sits in this chair is going to determine, can the United States just sit by? Sure, as far as the American people are concerned, they'd say, well, gee, these comments are all better. Nobody knows that better than I do. Nobody knows these people better than I do. And nobody has less confidence in what they are trying to do to us and will try to do to us if we ever even know them, if we become weak, or if we become not worth talking to. But looking at China and Russia, and of course this game is so sophisticated and so subtle that I wouldn't try to explain it too much. But looking at China and Russia, it's all part. You couldn't do one without the other. The China trip is directly related to the Russian initiative, and the Russian initiative is related to the China initiative. This we have to understand. But the most important thing is that looking at the Pacific, and three wars have started in the Pacific. World War II started there for us. Korea started there for us. Vietnam started there for us. What have we done? We have defused the possibility of another war coming from the Pacific by dealing directly with China and with 800 million people, soon to be a billion people in China. And we've also done it by maintaining a delicate balance with Japan. Very important to have that in mind. This is hard to do. This is done with mirrors. It's done by a lot of hard work, a lot of experience, a tough-minded attitude. Now you look at the Russians. What have we done there? Without giving it a thing on principle, we didn't give anything to the Chinese on principle. But what we have done there is, for the first time in the field of our arms control, we have really done something about limiting arms. You see, the test ban didn't mean anything. I mean, you can have a test ban. What's a test ban? Maybe you can test underground. So it's fine, but we're not going to have to test up the polluted air and so forth, which of course is no wise deal anyway. But the main point is that now, for the first time, we have made it again in limiting arms. We have a total limit on defensive nuclear weapons. We have the beginning of a limit on offensive nuclear weapons. But here's the important thing. We are now going to go after the Congress approves the offensive limitation, having already approved yesterday the defensive limitation. We go to phase two. Talk about phase two. Who do you want dealing with the Russians, with Russia, and now negotiating a limitation on all offensive weapons with the Russians, which could guarantee peace in the world for a long time to come, but which also will reduce the burden of arms invention? Do you want? I prepared it to answer. Do you want this fellow to go over there? Why? They take him in two bites. I mean, it must be so simple. I mean, not because he's a bad man, but because really, you can't be naive when you deal with these people. And because you can give each chapter and verse some of our conversations with the freshman, David Pound and the rest, but it's cold steel. That's the way it works. Now, the main point is, we have to continue what we've begun, and that means continuing this great initiative with the Chinese so that we will have negotiation and more communication, so that the world and young people grow up in, as I use the term, will be an open world. I'd like to have a lot of young people go to China. It's a marvelous experience. See, you won't like the system, but you will like the people. And that has never been possible before. And so here is the whole great Pacific area, which California has particularly to understand, Washington, Oregon, and the rest. Here it is. We changed the game. And it was never going to, and we have to continue to change it, because it isn't mean it's changed and now anybody can do it. This is a constant problem of nursing along, playing one not against the other, balancing one with the other. And with the Russians, we're moving on trade, we're moving on cooperation, and together we're in Russia. You see, up to the time, the very subtle changes occurred with the Russians. Before we met at the summit, the United States, even started an Eisenhower's period, already had a program with the Russians of exchange. But it was at arm's length. We could exchange information on space. We could exchange information on science. We could exchange information on medicine. And their science and our science, their diet and our diet, their spacemen and our spacemen, worked independently. What we have done, and this is the great change that has occurred in summer, we have now at the beginning Russian scientists and American scientists working together, of Russian doctors and American doctors working together to find the answer to cancer. A Russian scientist, basement, and American spacemen, here's the most graphic one, going together just about admire the Russian people. They're great people. And the Chinese people are great people. And we have got to find what this administration has done, what we have done, because we understand without compromising our principles, they haven't found some prize there, without making the world totally safe, that will never be totally safe for us, men and women, probably even more dangerous with women.
Yeah,
all of that. There are two places, one of the two places in the world where you've had the most trouble in this place is for women in the Middle East and one in South Asia. Nevertheless, you come down to this point. You see, you could say that we have these great initiatives have changed the world. And they've changed it not so much for the benefit of the older generation. I mean, we really didn't have to do it because we could have gotten along for 10 more years without everything. But looking ahead at the end of the century, we live in an entirely new world where Chinese and Americans may work together. Not always free, but we're together, at least not fighting each other. And we're Russians and Americans work together, and we're eventually we get this terrible danger, which of course frightens everybody, particularly younger people who study it. The danger of a nuclear disaster, get it under some kind of control. Because if the Russians and the Americans work together, they have the power to, of course, keep it from the ultimate tomorrow. But we've only begun. You see, you must point out that, gee, isn't it great? We've now had the opening to China, so it's all done. Anybody else can carry it. You can't say, particularly with regard to the Russians, gee, we now have arms control. We don't. It's only beginning. We've limited all defensive weapons. But the weapons that each of the two great powers has in its arsenals today would destroy civilization. So what we have to do now is to move from the limited offensive weapons to a new offensive agreement which covers other weapons as well. And then eventually, to offensive limitations, rather than offensive reductions in all ending weapons. And it's only then that the world becomes safer. Of course, the rules about their use, all that, you wouldn't hear more about that if you know the question. All of this, of course, will make the world safer. So what we really come down to is that when we came in, we had a war. When we came in, we had a situation of no dialogue at all with China. When we came in, we had a situation what appeared to be an inevitable arms race, continuation of the Russians, and no possibility of progress and cooperation. And now after 4 years, sure, we haven't ended the war, but we are ending it in a way that is not destroying the ability of the United States, well, at least respect the United States needs in the Middle East, for example, in Europe and in other countries, among its allies, who, if they feel that the United States can't be trusted, will desert its life. More important, in terms of the longer haul, the world will never be the same, and it'll be better. Some better. Don't overstate. Some better. Because of the initiative toward the Chinese, the initiative toward the Russians. But having taken these initiatives, we've got to continue them. Now, what man do you want to have to do? Who can you best trust to deal with the Russians and to make the world safer? Who has the experience? That's the kind of a pitch I think to them. I think they'll, can understand it. And they'll say, well, if we haven't done anything, then the opposition comes in and say, gee, it's time to have a new policy toward China. Or they could come in and say, it's time to have a new policy of arms control. You see, we've already done it, and we know how. And so what are you going to do? Put somebody else in who doesn't have the slightest idea as to how you start? See, I think this is the point.
Some people particularly appreciate the fact that you know Chinese leaders, you know the Soviet leaders, you've already talked with them, you've already negotiated with them, and they know you now, and you're just one heck of a long ways from where you were, and we're not sure it's going to work, but we're just one heck of a long ways from where, and this is not the time to stop.
Well, another point that you can make is, it's a small point, but we're just having traveled a lot, knowing a lot of people has improved. It's through the accident of history, through the fact that I was vice president for 3 years, and through the fact that out of office for years, I traveled a great deal on my own. I have traveled to more countries and therefore know on a personal basis more world leaders than any man in the world today, of course, and more than any American. And that's not a lie, that's not an asset easily to be cast aside because you talk about the Chinese, the Russians, it's important to know what a guy like Chechen was thinking about. And what makes him tick. was Brazil. 20 years from now, it's going to have 200 million people. And all these things, you see, whether it's that, and it's Sahara in Indonesia, which has 150 million people, whether it's Tanaka in Japan, whom I've known for 15 years, even though he's just now become prime minister. You see, knowing these people, knowing how, it's like with the football season coming on, why do you put an experienced quarterback? I mean, he knows the weaknesses, he knows where to throw the passes, he knows where not to throw, he knows where the cornerback is strong or he's weak. And so it is in this game. If you know him, you do a little bit better. You're not sure that you can solve it around the world. I wouldn't get to the final where we say, oh, the world is totally safe. It never is. I'd be quite honest about it. It's a dangerous world. And in a dangerous world, you can't take a chance with inexperience. That's how I find it, because it is a very dangerous world.
Do you think we can say that your trip to China was the thing that brought about, say, that the better relationship with North and South Korea and things like that?
I will simply say this. They are not related. I do not want to say, I don't think you should say that I say this, but I would simply go on and I'd say, look what has happened here. The trip to China took place. Then the relationship between North and South Korea changed. But look what has happened here. The situation in other parts of the world has changed. In other words, I take credit for it. But don't say that I claim it. But you should say it is significant to note that in every area of the world, the situation is better now than it was. Now, there's only one area where you can say probably that it isn't. And that's one that you can't think about. That's the India-Pakistan thing. But that's because India and Pakistan have hated each other since the time they were divided and will continue to. And there's much we can do about it. But nobody's too worried about that. I'm going to worry about Bangladesh. Most of them think Bangladesh is going to be kind of chill. Thing to mention most, though, is the foreign policy. although we didn't have that kind of crisis in the past, and I'm very sure we have 11. If you look back on that, I remember being in Slavic Sundays in our 12 session offices. It was a hard day for it, but I got it as nothing. The United States had I don't mean that it wasn't a tough decision, right? But we had a 15-1 or 20-1 advantage over the Soviet Union at that time in missiles. I mean, there's no way. The Cuban decision, the Kennedy made, was a tough one. I mean, eyeball, all that. Why, we were right down the Russians' throat. They wouldn't have dared done anything because we could have creamed them. But now, they made the decision. It was tough. That was tough because we were looking right across at the Russians. Equal. They didn't do anything because they wanted a summit. And so did we. But the main point about Agnew that I would make is that in the big decisions in which he has participated, I put it that way, because the vice president does not make decisions, he participates. The president consults him along with others in national security. The president has observed that he's a man who's at his best when going as Thomas, that he takes heat well, that he's a well-organized, competent man in handling big things. And I would stay off of, because there are negatives that are involved, I would stay off of his running battle with the press. Let that sort of skip to the background. I mean, we know what the press is. I mean, mainly against us. But I just stay off that because that, to many, is a negative. I would also point out that this idea that Agnew was to catch young people is malarkey. He isn't. The difficulty is he really ought to do more. He ought to become a foreign outside to do well. But I would say that the thing that will impress young people about him is that, now let's be fair, I'd say. Let's look at Agnew. And let's see how he has stood up. He's been criticized. He's been ridiculed. He's been lied about. And he's always kept his dignity and his poise. And great decisions have been made. He's been courageous and strong and supportive of President Wiley. That goes a long way.
Most young people that I talk to feel like he's not there for those decisions, so he's not showing any courage. He's just there to cut the press down
The difficulty with that, just so excuse me, we can't provide him. We say who's there. But he is, because you could say he's a member of the National Security Council, and that is where all the great decisions are discussed. As we don't vote on them, understand? The president has to make them. The president asks everybody, and you find out which are the strong men, which are the weak men. The weak men will say, which he doeth a little work. Strong man will say, well, that's very true. And several of them, I understand. A strong man will say, well, I've thought this thing through, it's a tough decision. But I think we ought to do it. That's what it takes a lot of guts. You see, he's putting his whole reputation on the line. Most men, I suppose this is true, never like to express an opinion, particularly in an office here, which may be proven wrong. Most men like to play it safe and like to say, what you hear, you know best. I don't know more about that. So why do you call them in? I go usually in the cabinet and find 14 out of the 15. We'll say, well, let me examine this report, this report. I hope you bought them all. Of course, if I hadn't bought them all, I wouldn't be asking them. But nevertheless, and then now and then you'll find one that'll stand up and say, I think you ought to do it. And Agnew's that kind of a man. That's the point you should make. Okay, I just use the word guts. People like that too. That particularly for younger you. See, he's got guts. He's got it. But also, poise, judgment. In other words, let me just say, have you ever seen an unflappable? Have you ever seen him break down? Right? He's had plenty of reasons to. And when they think of somebody in that chair having to make a tough decision, they want somebody who's, we talk all we want about emotion and so forth. And Churchill used to cry when he did last night. Okay. But Churchill didn't cry when he had to make the tough decision. You want a pretty cool guy in that chair.
Well, anyway, there's a great
quote that you could want to use. Let me see if I can find it over here. You did you read about do you remember Mr. Dooley?
Many of you, when you study political science, Benny Peter Dunn, Mr. Dooley,
Gilbert, he's the great, he's the great humorist of the late, the latter part of the 19th century.
I don't try to get this quote in the way that I remember that Al Barkley once told me about this. He was a kid about the office of vice presidency. And he told me about this quote, and I looked it up recently, and the quotes I found relation to the vice presidency. And here's Mr. Julia. So this is his dissertation, Mr. Julia, 1906. That's all PR, the spread of the PR having become president, as you know. And then running for re-election and being re-elected in 1904. He talks about the presidency. He says the presidency is the highest office to give to the people. The vice presidency is the highest and the lowest. He said, it isn't a crime exactly. You can't be sent to jail for it. But it's a kind of a disgrace. That must be the problem government's having. Well, we wish you the best, and appreciate your hard work. Well, do they all have a, you know, you've got your conference, you've got
your conference. No,
it's
none of them, sir.
I don't know that we can afford it for you.
Mueller started to tell me when they came in on the water meeting, what is it, what did you say they about that national and so forth, how they thought they could handle that? Or did they go?
I'm not sure, but they, what I started to tell you is that new development, and Wayne Andrews called Clark and said, I don't know who to talk to, so I want to talk to you. Said, first of all, I was the source of the $25,000. That is now under question.
Yeah.
I gave it to
Dollar.
Said, I've been thinking about it, and I'd be prepared to release a statement. And he read the statement to Clark. It would be to this effect, if you people want me to do it. He said, I didn't think about it. I don't know whether this is good or bad. and says, I'm an independent. I've always been a political independent. I have supported candidates primarily in the Democratic Party. I've been very close, particularly, and provide a very major degree of support to Hubert Humphrey. However, in this election, I feel and have felt very strongly that it's absolutely imperative that the president be reelected. And I am supporting him for that reason. Consonant with that support, I made the contribution of $25,000 to the president's reelection campaign prior to the reporting date, because from my position, it obviously was not desirable to have my name on a campaign list because of my long association with Senator Humphrey and others. And some to that effect. And that may have enormous political benefit to us, not just because it cleans up this thing, which it may well do, but because it explains the $10 million. It, then you say, the reason he says we have no thought of doing that is for exactly the reason Mr. Andreas has pointed out.
Yeah, there are a lot of them.
And there were some voters like that.
He said, I naturally take a long time to win Democratic. I did not want to contribute before that time.
Because it was the law specifically provided for
it. The law provided for that. I did not want to dispose of it. No, I knew I should dispose of it.
Because of this question that's arisen about it, I feel I should. And of course, you could say because Senator Humphrey is now clearly out of it.
Yeah. I think it's imperative to do that. I don't know if you want to get McGregor involved in this.
Oh, you wouldn't get McGregor involved.
No, what I mean is make him a decision.
Well, he's involved in the sense that Andreas knows him better than anybody else.
Sure. Well, I called him. So they're going to have
Carter called Earthman and me just right up the meeting this morning and said he needed to see us for him. Told us that. And both John and I felt that it was probably a good idea for a political benefit.
We have done no matter what.
There may be some negatives. Well, but the problem is that it's quite likely under this GAO investigation that Andreas is going to come out anyway. If he is, we're infinitely better off to have him put out a statement before he is turned up than to let them turn him up and then have him have to explain. And then we can play back the fact that Duane Andreas and hundreds of other Democrats are supporting the president, as will become clear in this campaign. Many of them politically, others financially. Some of them openly, and some of them, for their very valid reasons, not openly.
Right.
Now we can tie that back to congressmen, senators, and other Democratic office holders. Make the point that many of them are supporting the president, privately, although they, of course, can't publicly declare.
Yeah. Well, the plan is still quite as you described it today, to have an indictment.
Sure as hell, we've got to keep Mitchell out. We could survive when Mooters involved. We would have a real problem with Mitchell's involvement.
Okay.
And I think we're, apparently, we're all free on that.
McGruder hasn't testified yet. We don't know if you want to know
that. I don't think so.
Okay, I'm on the way.
If you'll do all right, I'll testify. I was just thinking it might. Well, we don't put on a name list. If you have another campaign group, that might not be a bad idea to let McGruder sit in it. You didn't want him on the boat or something where names, you know, our identity could come out with. You had six or eight people in here. You know, one of them. Not to get his name out, but just to look at, in a sense, sort of put your, not saying anything, but just so he isn't.
Feel he's ostracized.
Doesn't feel he's ostracized. He knows that he is public.
Well,
in a sense,
right. As far as I'm concerned.
But the personal part of
it. What we might do is sometime we do something over maybe he's old easy, we ought to do it, because that's not true.
Yeah.
We might let him know or something like that.
It's no problem. Jeff's in and out of here. I mean, you know,
Dan, I think the Andrews thing was a good move. But now who's going to follow up on that?
I'll talk to John again, and he was going to try and figure out what negatives
John
Irwin
and John Dean to those goals.
And I've got to check with John Dean because he's determined whether. See,
yeah,
maybe faster, you don't know.
And he said, I contributed the money. I did not want, I did it before they set up because I did not want my name since I was a supporter and not to be out.
As was, I did it under the provisions of the law that permitted me to do it. No, there was no attempt to circumvent the law. There was a desire to make it a private contribution. Law provided for that. Then you have the technical thing. If they're early, legally feels we have no problem on it, but Hughes's view at the moment is that delivery to Dahlgren didn't constitute the making of the contribution, and it had to be turned to the committee. That seems to be a little absurd. If Dahlgren was the Midwest Financial
Committee,
he is the committee.
Sure.
And when you turn it over to an agent, what does that mean? You have every nickel has to be handed more than he stands, or
it's a
accomplishment. It's a good, it's, well, it's an accomplishment, and it's philosophically, it's a good talking point. It's a power to the people, and, you know, it, there's a, it sounds good.
What the hell are you talking about? It doesn't, it isn't embedded to you at all.
It's true.
But it certainly puts no negatives in the process.